And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
This is the Hagman Report. Welcome, folks. In fact, we've got listeners right now listening to this live all over the United States, Canada. And we just heard from a couple of people in Europe, including Karen. God bless you, Karen. Thank you so much, Karen, from Rome, Italy. Glad you're okay after that spate of earthquakes. For new listeners, folks, we broadcast live each and every weeknight, Monday through Friday, that is, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Global Star Radio Network. It's the place to be. And of course, if you have a computer, which a lot of people believe is the perfect, most perfect seat in the house, to borrow a phrase from Spaceman, right in front of your computer, watching it on YouTube live. We're also simulcast on Blog Talk Radio. And also, you can catch us. I'll tell you what, folks. Just go to HagmanandHagman.com. And there you can choose your listening and viewing venue. We've got two different websites, Hagman and Hagman.com. That's for show information. And also HagmanReport.com. Their show prep. And up on HagmanReport.com, we've got, I wrote an article today, and actually it's on HagmanReport.com as well as on the cover of CanadaFreePress.com. Folks, visit CanadaFreePress.com as well and take a look at the article that addresses, well, that's actually kind of an open letter. I felt like I was writing an open letter to the acting chairman of the NTSB, and that's Christopher Hart. Christopher Hart, if you happen to be viewing or listening to this, please do the right thing. I know you can, and I know certainly that you will. That's based on an article by our guest tonight. We have with us tonight Mr. Jack Cashel. He's the author of TWA 800, and of course the book is featured prominently right here. And, of course, TWA 800, the crash, the conspiracy, and the cover-up. I might have gotten that backwards. Did I get that backwards?
The crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy.
I do that all the time, even in conversation. But our in-studio guest, we're so pleased to have Jack Cashel with us. Just a prolific author, a writer for American Thinker. His website, jackcashel.com, writer for WorldNet Daily as well, WND. And a tremendous, in my view, a tremendous investigative journalist, one who brings facts to the table, not speculation. And, of course, this book, TWA 800, is, in fact, a book full of investigative conclusions, facts brought to the table for you, the audience, you, the jury, to assess. Portion of this broadcast brought to you by Minuteman Stove. Minuteman Stove. Folks, you know, be prepared for any eventuality. And if you are, I'm sure you have storable food in your pantry. If you do, how are you going to cook that food if you're without utilities, if you're without gas or electric? Well, Minuteman Stove is the answer. Minuteman Rocket Stove provides you the ability to cook without power. Just a few sticks is all that's needed. And you can boil water. Even if you're camping this Labor Day, think about that. You could take this stove with you camping if that is your desire. And it really is. Or if you live in an apartment or mobile home or some place where the quarters are close, Minuteman Rocket Stove is the answer for all of your cooking needs. Now, we're going to just get right into the program. Joe, first of all, welcome to the studio.
Great to be here.
Just in the nick of time. And, of course, our guest, Mr. Jack Cashel. We're so pleased to have him. And with him is Mr. Privatera, who hopefully we can get to, and we'll get to later on in the program to talk about some related issues, but additional issues about what could be in store for us end of this year, beginning of next year, and throughout 2017. Hopefully that'll be the case. But right now, let's introduce Jack Cashel. Jack Cashel, thank you so much for being a part of our studio. Thanks for appearing in studio with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Doug and Joe, and it's good to see you guys again. We just saw you
yeah.
A few days ago, actually.
That's right.
It was
a
very
great
nice
conversation.
Beautiful place, and just fantastic event there that we were invited to, and want to say thank you for that. We had a great time.
Absolutely.
Actually, I have a place just up the lake. Yeah, we're on the lake here because I'm here right now. And, I have a place on the New York side, state of the on Lake Erie, and we had a bunch of oddball crank right-wing conspiracy. Especially against Doug and Joe Hagman.
You know, I got to tell you, I felt like we were at the epicenter of the vast right-wing conspiracy.
The alt-right.
Right there. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. But no, it was a good fellowship and wonderful people and just a tremendous gathering there. But the other thing, I was so embarrassed because it was at that event, Jack, that I realized how little I really knew about history.
we participated in some trivia
in a test.
And he should be writing questions for Jeopardy over here.
Yeah.
I was impressed. Everyone did pretty well.
Well, not everyone.
I mean, we did it by teams. It's a concept that I've introduced, I've done elsewhere, and I call it the civics bowl. And the questions are designed to be both kind of entertaining and informative, you know, with some civics, you know, gist. Like one question was, a local question was, which president was inaugurated in Buffalo, New York?
Right.
And if you could deduce your way to that if you know enough about history. And that is, why would someone be inaugurated in Buffalo? And then the answer is, of course, that your predecessor was murdered in Buffalo.
There you go.
And that was William McKinley, and his successor was his vice president, Theodore Roosevelt. So, I mean, the answers are the kind where you, when you hear them, you'd say, oh, of course, rather than, what?
Yeah.
You know, how am I supposed to guess that? You know?
Yeah, Joe and I and another beautiful woman that was there, just a sweet lady. We came in dead last. We pulled in the wagon dead last on that. So there it is, folks. But anyway, but Jack, it was you were here. It was the end of
ago.
Yeah, the end of June.
Right? Yep.
And of course, a lot of real estate, a lot of time, a lot of things happened between your last appearance and today. And that was 2 weeks roughly before the
20th anniversary. Right?
Well, yeah, I mean,
even before the book came out. Right?
Yeah,
and TW 800 book. And it's been 2 months, so a little less than 2 months since the book came out. And it's been really fascinating to watch the response. And that's, and part of what I would, you know, would like to talk about tonight is how the media react, how the public reacts, and how the government reacts when they're faced with an incontrovertible truth.
Right.
That has major historic consequences.
But we need to discuss that. Now, people may be listening or watching this program tonight thinking or asking, hey, we're talking about an event that took place 20 years ago. Really, 1996, 20 years ago this year, 230 people were killed in this event just off of Long Island, New York. TWA 800, for those of you who don't recall, that was a very controversial investigation that was conducted. The attribution to the devastation was the center fuel tank that exploded, and of course, from that it was just an incredible, incredible is probably the best word. Center fuel tank explosion, the CIA rendition of the climbing following the event, and then of course the debris fields, which you get into in the book. But what's the relevance? I mean, why talk about it today?
It's interesting because I was. When I've done mainstream interviews, I have to downplay the relevance of it for today. For instance, I did an interview on New York One, and it was a two-hour interview. It was taped. New York One is the New York City's, you know, prime cable channel, news
right.
channel, 24-hour news channel.
Yep.
And they asked me at the end of it, "You think this? If this story came out, do you think it would affect the 2016 election?" And I already knew these guys tipped me off with their preferences for it, you know? So I said, no, I can't imagine it would. It's, you know, it's kind of a slow, winding story. And, you know, even if it came out, it wouldn't. But of course it would! That's why the major media don't want to talk about this. Because the very same people who were trying to get back into the White House in 1996 by covering this up are trying to get back into the White House in 2016 by keeping it covered up.
That's right.
And there's a very strong parallel. Well, we had a parallel in 2012, with Benghazi.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I may have mentioned this when I was on last time, but in a very good documentary came out in 2013 called TWA Flight 800, produced by a former CBS producer named Christina Borgeson.
Mm-hmm.
And it got excellent reviews. It got attention in the major media. These people were scrupulously apolitical, and they
It was pretty savvy on their part. 2013, you know, you can afford to be that. So I was asked to be on CNN to talk about it, even though I wasn't associated with it. They knew I had a background in investigating TWA 800. So I was on a TWN morning show with a woman named Allison Kozik was the hostess. And at the end of it, with about a minute left, it was only a five-minute segment, and some other guy's refuting what I'm saying. You know how these go. She goes, okay, Jack, if it was a missile that brought down the plane, who shot it, why did they shoot it, and why the cover-up? And there are less than 90 seconds left, you know. So I said, well, let me just get right to the cover-up. I said, that I can answer authoritatively. I said, this was Bill Clinton's Benghazi moment. I said, he's looking at a national security disaster on the eve of the Democratic National Convention, an election that he thinks he's going to win without this. And he panicked and just tried to kick this can down the road past November, you know?
Sure.
And then she says, well, thank you, Jack. Appreciate that. Next morning, I, you know, look at the transcript. My answer has been edited out, right?
Nice.
It's gone. If the people who are watching this think, oh, the major media are biased, now, they're beyond bias. Bias implies that there's some degree of impartiality, you know. Now, they're into full-blown media corruption. And the best way to corrupt the news is to suppress the news that's inconvenient and uncomfortable.
Let me ask you this, Jack. You know, we see, and especially in this election cycle, the, you know, the amount of media manipulation in this country, and the covering up for Hillary Clinton and the, you know, tearing down and the deceptive editing with Donald Trump. Back in 96, and I was 20 years ago, I was only 13 years old then. How much worse is the media manipulation today, if at all, from 1996?
Well, I was only about 14 or 15. You know, your father was obviously much older than I am. No, it was, they at least faked objectivity in 96. Okay. Even in 2012, I've never seen anything like this year.
Mm-hmm.
This year, it's laughable.
It is.
You know, it's beyond. It's reached a point where even the people on the left see what's happening. You know, for instance, I'll give you an example of how it works, and how subtle. I mean, how not subtle it is, but how in your face it is. I have an AOL account, right? Because I've had it for a long time, but you know, I open up AOL, and then there's these news items. And they're comically lopsided. And it's as though they're written by some 25-year-old who's scared that Donald Trump will become president, you know. And there's no way. They spin everything, you know. Any rumor is posted as news, and it's always protective of Hillary. And it's, you know, if the polls are running in her favor, it's, you know, it's up there every day. Polls are running against her. You don't hear any sign of it, you know. Nothing that Donald Trump says can't be parsed into some sort of, you know, hateful thing. You know, it's just mind-boggling.
So we've gone to a slight, well, we've gone to a relatively overt or covert bias, or at least some sort of there was some level of decorum there, if that's what you want to call the.
Yeah.
You know, now it's just overt and in your face.
And you know, the Obama White House certainly knows that. They talked about that. When this guy, in fact, his brother, help me out with the name, his brother is the head of CBS.
Rhodes.
Ben Rhodes. He talked about how they just use these people. He said the average one is like 27 years old and doesn't know anything. And they just run with whatever press releases we hand them and then turn it into news. And he was mocking them. They can openly mock the very people he's exploiting, and they don't seem to take umbrage at it, you know?
It's sad. The American people, I think, have to, we need a wake-up call. I think we need to really put our feet down. Yeah. I think we need to put our feet down here, and I think we need to expose, obviously, what's taking place. And I think we're doing that in large part, but
we see the transition from the cable news, you know, regular TV, mainstream news outlets, and the level of viewership as that continues to be chipped away at and fades away, to the point where, you know, some CNN to MSNBC shows aren't even pulling in, you know, half the numbers of some of the alternative news stations today, where, you know, 20 years ago that wasn't the case. There wasn't an alternative media. And due to the internet, we've been able to really branch out And
yeah, I mean, Joe, you check our numbers, and I mean, our numbers are I'm not sure if this is a badge of honor or anything, but certainly ahead of many of the MSNBC shows. You know, I mean, far, far ahead of those. And we're second based on this, the metrics, to Alex Jones on the alternative media side. So we are, the penetration is there. People are listening. People are watching. I'm not sure if I made my point, but regardless, I think people are turning away from the mainstream, or at least most people.
Enough people.
Enough mm-hmm. people. But
hopefully.
We need more, though.
Yeah.
Well, Jack, getting into your book, and folks, if you have not purchased, gotten yourself a copy of Jack's book, it's well worth it. It's worth it at any cost, in terms of really, it lays out the entirety, it brings forth documentation, evidence, not proof, but evidence, in at least by definition, in my view, that, anything but the center fuel tank was the issue. But it goes a little bit further. It shows the internal workings of the conspiracy itself and the consequential result of what was fed to the American public. Well, let me start by asking this. How has the book been received?
That's a very good question, because there are it's gotten some interesting coverage. Mm-hmm. For instance, New York Post ran a big article. Mm-hmm. The London Daily Mail ran a big article.
Saw that.
The Newark Star Ledger, New Jersey Star, whatever they call it. Now, it used to be Newark Star Ledger when I delivered it. Now they disassociated themselves from Newark, but it's the biggest paper in New Jersey. Star Ledger ran a big article. Beyond that, you know, talk radio has always been good. I was on the Sean Hannity show, did Coast to Coast. I haven't penetrated Alex Jones. I don't quite understand that. So if you got some juice there, talk to him for me. The major media, of course, have been utterly, totally indifferent, other than the ones I just cited.
Right.
There's no penetrating them at all. They simply don't want to know. And equally problematic is the respectable right media, the National Review, Weekly Standard, crowd.
Right.
You know?
You would think that they would jump on something like this.
Especially given its political implications.
Sure.
And, I had, for instance, a long talk with the publisher of National Review, and the reason I got to talk to him was because we went to the same New York City high school, and it was kind of a special place. So if you're an alum, you get to take a phone call, you know?
Right.
And I was telling him about the book. I said, yeah, it's political consequences. And then I said, but you guys are kind of on the fence about this here, aren't they? And then he just went off on this tirade, you know? Just because, you know, lots of F-bombs and, you know, people from New York never get too far from using the F-bombs, but and then he was saying that just because we don't like Donald Trump doesn't mean that we want Hillary to win. I said, well, it kind of gives that impression, you know.
Yeah.
But they're certainly not eager to jump in on this and to find a weapon that they could use against her. Same thing with Weekly Standard. I used to write for the Weekly Standard. This is Bill Kristol, mm-hmm. Fred Barnes.
That's right, over Trump crowd.
And it's there is a well-written magazine, and you know, some of the stuff they write makes sense. And they are fundamentally conservative on most issues. But when I sent them, I just a little blurb, I got an email back from them. It's a 9-word-long email. I don't remember the exact word, but no one here has any interest in this book. Period. You know.
Wow.
I mean, it was that stark, right? No one here. How many words? No one here has any. It was that stark, though.
Wow.
Okay. You know, that's great. Thanks. Appreciate that. Has anyone read it? Do you know what the thesis is? Is it, this is the great untold story of our time? A story that, if told honestly and accurately, will dwarf Watergate and its implications?
That's right.
And, no, we have no interest in it here, you know, so that's what I'm facing right now.
And also the, I don't want to say trolls, but I was watching the Amazon rankings. And that's kind of an interesting dynamic, interesting metric on Amazon, you know, how the scale goes
right.
up. And then the comments, of course, I saw the NTSB weighed in, or officially or unofficially, on your commentary.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because about 80% of the reviews on Amazon are 5-star, right?
Right, right.
But then they drop into 1-star reviews. They do this consciously to pull your numbers down. They do it to all conservative
audience. Sure.
So I'm not really offended by that. But when Peter Goltz, former managing director of the NTSB, weighs in, first he compares me to Joe McCarthy. Now, which one of us is using government power to abuse people? It's not me. I mean, to compare me to Joe McCarthy? What a nutty comparison.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was better, though. And then next paragraph, he compares me to Daffy Duck.
I saw that.
And then he goes on to trot out once more the most discredited of all explanations. He goes to his explanation, which they've been using the last few years when they have to go before talking heads. He and FBI honcho Jim Kallstrom say the same thing. Well, no. Everyone heard a sound, and then they looked up, and by our sound propagation analysis, we deduced that they could only have seen the last 6 seconds of this event. Well, no one believed this. See, I went back, and in the book, what I do is I took out the 40 most observant of the eyewitnesses.
Right.
Of those 40, 9 of them, the FBI didn't even ask them about sound, right? That's how sloppy that initial interview sequence was. 14 heard no sound at all. That's 23 out of 40. 14 of the remaining 17 heard some sound that had nothing to do with what the sound that Peter Goltz said they heard, and only 3 of the 40 heard any kind of sound that might have conformed to what he was saying. Now, when the FBI's final report didn't even mention sound, right? The NTSB's final report discounted sound entirely. The sound propagation analysis was this utterly nonsensical thing put together by the CIA to discredit the eyewitnesses. And here's Peter Goltz rolling this out like 2 weeks ago.
Right.
Not knowing. If he had read my book, he would have known better than to do that, because I thoroughly just trashed that analysis. And as though it was, he should be listened to and paid attention to. But you're thinking, why is a government employee, a guy who's made his living, you know, on my dime and your dime,
that's right,
trashing his fellow citizens who are just trying to get at the truth? But that's what they roll. That's how they do it.
Yeah, and that's the tactic. I think that's a common tactic that we see, you know, on many areas and in many subjects. But I was impressed really by the objectivity. The investigative objectivity. You went into this, at least from my point of view as an investigator, you did not look at this and work it from a predetermined conclusion backwards. You went in just open-minded, looking at all of the facts, all of the evidence, and laying it out. And that's what investigators do, at least good investigators, without an agenda, and that's what you did. So many people, and we heard from a lot of people after your first appearance here on the Hagman and Hagman Report, so many people wanted to know so many things. Like, for example, what was the, when in the course of in the history of the NTSB have they turned over or relented to the intrusion of the CIA?
Well, you know, one thing that, in fact, you talked about that, and I wrote about that last week, and it was called My Improbable Lunch with the Chairman of the NTSB.
That's right.
And of course, what happened is, just in the way of backdrop, because I'll tell that story, because it'll explain what happens afterwards. We did a press conference with Accuracy and Media. By the way, thank you, Accuracy and Media. They stepped up big time here. They had no financial interest in this project at all, and they just did it because that's what they do, in Washington at the National Press Club. It was not overly well attended by the media, as you might imagine, but it did what we needed to do, because we created a video of it. The night before, I called Vernon Gross, who is a former NTSB board member, an applied physicist, former air traffic controller. There's probably no one in America more knowledgeable about airplane crashes than Gross. And he helped me with the book, because what happened is that, and here's how good his credentials are. On the night of the crash, on July 17, 1996, he got a call from CNN. Can you come in and provide on-air commentary? They kept him for the 6 hours straight into the night, through the night. He said he only took one bathroom break the whole time. Otherwise, he was on the air. He had subsequently done 170 interviews on TWA Flight 800.
Wow.
And for the first 2 years, he was largely supportive of the investigation. And then his eyes began to open as more and more information became available. And now he's a total skeptic. I mean, he's on board. He fully believes that there was a cover-up, that missiles did shoot down the plane. So I didn't even know where he lived, but I happened to call him the day before the press conference, and he realized he lived in Arlington, Virginia. And I said, well, Vernon, you know, we're having a press conference in Washington tomorrow. Why don't you come in down, you know? He said, over time. Then I said, National Press Club. He comes down, and he's there. And so Roger Aronoff of Accuracy and Media says, I presented a witness. CIA witness number one was there, the man on the bridge, Mike Wire.
Yeah.
John Clark, the attorney who's done so much to get this story before the public. And so then Roger says to Vernon, why don't you come up and talk for a few minutes? And Vernon says, oh, sure, why not? So he speaks for about 10 minutes. This is all recorded. Afterwards, we go to lunch, and we're talking, and then Gross says to me, he goes, hey, by the way, tomorrow I'm having lunch with the chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to say, hey, can I come, you know?
Sure.
But then about a half hour later, he brings it up again and says, hey, why don't you come, Jack? I said, well, that's great. I said, because I have a flight about an hour after that, he was meeting at the Pentagon Mall. I was flying out of National, which is just down the road. So I get there. It's like Smokey Joe's, I don't know, barbecue or someplace. And Vernon's there, and then I get there. And then Christopher Hart comes in. And I didn't know Hart at all, although I had written about him earlier.
Hang on, Jack.
Yeah.
Folks, you're going to have to hang with us for this. This is great. This talks about Jack Cashel's improbable lunch with the chairman of the NTSB. If you haven't read it, it does appear on American Thinker. It was published on Monday, this past Monday. And, of course, jackcashel.com is
just... actually cashel.com, Doug, just to clarify that. So
cashel.com.
Yeah.
Right. See? Thank you, Jack. Yeah. But his improbable lunch with the chairman of the NTSB, what a fantastic account he gives. Hagman and Hagman with our special in-studio guest, Jack Cashel. Stay right where you're at.
Yeah, what am I talking about? We got a few minutes. Can I get there? Oh, my mic.
GWA 800, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy. Folks, we are joined in studio by author and friend Jack Cashel. This is his second in-studio appearance that we've done in the last few months, and it's a pleasure to have him here today.
You have to be paying him gas mileage.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it. Not too far away. By the way, it's a beautiful drive down here this evening. Going through all those vineyards and whatnot on the way in northeast Pennsylvania and southwest New York State.
You know, it's such a pleasure to have you. You know, I've followed your work for so many years, even back to Ron Brown's Body, that came out in 2004. But just a tremendous investigator. But before the break, we were talking about your improbable meetup and lunch with the acting chairman of the NTSB. And Vernon Gross, folks, who he mentioned, is no slouch. Read his article on American Thinker and Cashel.com, TWA, My Improbable Lunch with the Chairman of the NTSB, you'll see that Vernon Gross, of course, has quite the resume. But having said that, Christopher Hart does as well. So go ahead and continue with what happened and how that came about and what was said there.
I was just saying, he's fascinating to talk to just in terms of resume. Oh, he said, yeah, I knew all the Apollo 7 astronauts, and I've talked to every guy who's ever walked on the moon, you know, things like that. He just casually dropped them in. So, but we go, and Christopher Hart is the third one at lunch, and he's not expecting me. But he handled it pretty gracefully, you know, and Vernon didn't hesitate to plug me, show him the book, and talk about what I was doing, you know? And Hart just took it pretty casually. And I figured my job that lunch was to find some connection with Hart and also to convince him of my sanity. You know, that I'm just not some sort of whack job from, you know, the blogosphere someplace who's come in to ruin a perfectly nice lunch with Vern Gross. So that's what I set out to do. But then every 10 minutes, 5 minutes, Vern would jump in and say, hey, yeah, Chris, you really have to read this book. You know, he really nails it. But we're talking, and then we find the point of connection, which is fascinating. And it opens a window on a larger political manipulation that had gone on. And just casually, Chris was talking about his background. And he says, you know, I was on the board earlier from 1990 to 93, and then I was replaced by Jim Hall. I said, you're the guy. I said, because I wrote about that in my book. And I said, you know, and I mentioned in the book that that Bill Clinton had replaced a fellow with a master's degree in aerophysics from Princeton, a Harvard Law degree,
yep,
an instrument-rated pilot, with a guy, and then I described the Washington Post article that talked about this. A columnist said he was replaced by a guy with a whose best transportation credential was apparently his driver's license. That was Jim Hall, who's a political hack and Al Gore crony from Tennessee. But there were a couple things I didn't know about Chris Hart when I wrote that. Well, for one, as he admitted, he was a Democrat.
Yep.
And more importantly, think about this. He's black. He's an African-American.
Right.
He's a uniquely qualified African-American. His credentials are impeccable, you know?
That's right.
And so intent was Bill Clinton on politicizing that board and making it, putting it under his political control, a board that had been established. There's only five members on the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board. And he replaced Hart with a guy with zero qualifications. First time ever that happened. The next two appointees, by the way, within a year, Jim Hall, the crony, is made chairman, right?
Nice.
And then the next two appointees are both political insiders, political operatives. Each of them has a little more transportation background than Hall, but not much. And so by 1996, what foresight on the Clintons, you know, that when TWA 800 goes down, they've got the NTSB board in their pocket. Who else? I mean, how deeply corrupt do you have to be to anticipate you'll need to control the board of the National Transportation Safety Board? And to do that, you've got to get rid of, like, probably the most qualified black in this business, right?
That's right. Yeah, and Mr. Hart's got, in addition to his resume, I mean, his family has quite the legacy.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, he was, let's see here, his family has a tradition of accomplishment in the field of transportation. His great uncle, James Banning, was the first African American to receive a pilot's license issued by the U.S. government back in 1926. So,
yeah. It makes sense, though. I'm going to jump in here because if you look at the Clinton body count, and whatever, you know, people tie certain political and other murders into this long list of people that have died mysteriously with ties to Clinton. Almost half of them, or close to that, are plane crashes.
That happens, and also there's a lot of minorities get killed on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Including Ron Brown, and who both dies in a plane crash, and is probably the most popular black guy on Clinton's cabinet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, bottom line is... and, you know, for African-American viewers, you're expendable. You know, push comes to shove, you are expendable.
Black Lives Matter, except when it's not convenient.
For instance, just a slight deviation here. How many African-Americans do you think know that at Waco in 1993, April 19th, 93, 74 people were killed in that religious community?
Right.
We have to call it a compound to dehumanize them.
Sure.
More than half of them, 39 of the 74, were racial minorities. 27 of them were black, right?
Wow.
Who knows that? That was a fact that was totally suppressed by the media because the FBI had given the people inside the community cameras and they had taken videos of themselves, right? Totally suppressed fact. So that when it's politically useful, African Americans could be trotted up on stage and they'd be shown off as trophies. But when they're not useful or when there's another purpose to be served, they can be dispatched. They could be dismissed as Christopher Hart was, killed as Ron Brown was, or, you know, annihilated as the sure. people at Waco were, and then their very identity as blacks suppressed.
I didn't know that. Yeah. About Waco, the makeup, the,
I only learned it counting. I got a list of the dead, and it had them by race and age. You know,
wow,
age 6 to 60. You know,
yeah.
and 27 of them black.
Yeah. Again, yeah, expendable indeed. Wow. All right. Well, so here we have Christopher Hart at this point, and I just kind of really want to drive this home because this touched me a little bit, and folks, I wrote about this. In fact, my article appeared in Canada Free Press. If you go to canadafreepress.com, the cover of Canada Free Press, check out my article about the one man who can make a difference, who can make a big difference in this, and that's Christopher Hart. He's given the opportunity to take this. I would love, I mean, from an investigative point of view, Jack, the information, you know, your book serves as, I would call it an investigative aid. I mean, you recap the investigation, highlight it. In fact, you've given an overview in addition to the book of an overview to Mr. Hart. So this is kind of a lay down type kind of investigation. I mean, the facts are there. The work has been done.
Right. And, Vern Gross had a copy of the book with him, but yeah, he kept it. I'd already signed it to him. So I immediately FedExed the copy of the book to Chris Bart and, you know, gave him his business card, et cetera.
Sure.
And I gave him a quick outline, you know, like that goes with it, just so in case he doesn't read the book. Well, the follow-up of this is there's an interesting twist on this story. About 2 weeks, I didn't hear from Chris Hart. I'm not really expecting to. I can imagine the institutional pressures that are on him.
Sure.
You know, it would take an extraordinary person to step up. If he is that person, I'd be thrilled. If he's not, I would not be, you know, overly surprised or even disappointed, because that's what you expect. But 2 weeks after our meeting, Vern Gross, former NTSB, board member, gets an email from a guy named David Token, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, who's a general counsel for the National Transportation Safety Board. And it says, it has come to our attention that at the Accuracy Media press conference, you were wearing NTSB insignias or regalia, and you were representing yourself as a member of the National Transportation Safety Board. We want to remind you that this is,
it's a no-no.
No-no, blah, yeah, blah, 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 blah. In the future, don't do anything like this again. So Gross sends me the email, and he says, I asked him, I said, are you going to respond? He goes, no, this is just too demeaning. He goes, I'm not going to bother responding. I said, do you mind if I respond? He said, no, go right ahead. You know, so I sent Token a letter, an email, and I said to him, I said, if you'll take a look at this video, you know, because Accuracy Media videotaped the event, you'll see that Vern Gross is not wearing any NTSB regalia, and he is not representing himself as a member of the National Transportation Safety Board.
Right.
So I expect I would never hear it again from Token, the general counsel. But lo and behold, 2 days later, I get he sends an email to Gross, and he CCs me apologizing. He goes, I am sorry. I was told, you know, he said a member of the public told me this. I wonder, they have a plant there. I don't know who, I don't know how this got back to him, but I'm a little wary of how it got back to him. But, and he said, I didn't see the video. If I'd known there was a video, I wouldn't have, you know, I would have watched it and double checked.
Yeah.
Well, but then how did he think to say that, you know?
Yeah. And that always, you know, in situations like that, that always causes me a little pause.
And there was another kicker on that email.
Okay.
From Token, the general counsel. He says, oh, by the way, I bought your book, and I've already read the first five chapters. Well, if he read the first five chapters, he knows that the CIA, the FBI illegally took the investigation over from the NTSB, but they did it publicly, and the CIA covertly took over the investigation from the NTSB, that the whole thing is utterly corrupt, that the evidence is inarguable. He knows that,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I presume Chris Hart knows that. Now, about in 2013 and 2014, this group called the TW-800 Project, they were responsible for the documentary TW Flight 800,
right,
which I mentioned earlier. They very systematically petitioned the NTSB to reopen the investigation. And they had a lot of juice. I mean, they had the head of it's a physicist, Tom Stalkup.
Yep.
They had Hank Hughes, is his partner in this. Hank Hughes was the guy, the NTSB senior investigator responsible for reconstructing the airplane in the hangar in Calverton, Long Island. They have at least four or five other whistleblowers. They have 20 family members. They have a dozen key eyewitnesses that put together this petition, and they got turned down step after step after step. Token was the guy sending them their rejection letters. Chris Hart did not join the board until very late in this process, after, in fait, it had been essentially a fait accompli. So it's not impossible for him at this stage to step up. And it's going to take something like that for that to happen.
Okay, and I really want to drive this point home, because Christopher Hart, if you are listening, or if you happen upon this video or audio, you know, I notice here it says Honorable Christopher A. Hart. You know, that title, the honorable part, used to have some meaning, and I certainly would, if I was in your position, I'd be looking at myself in the mirror every day, and you know, thinking about my children, the legacy in which I'm going to leave, and also the honor that you could restore back to the NTSB, and the honor that you can restore back to the country as a whole, the integrity that you could display by your actions. And I'm just saying that, you know, I suppose Christopher Hart, as the acting chairman of the NTSB,
he's the actual chairman. He's
not the chairman?
Yeah.
Okay. Can he, I mean, if he wanted to, and again, I know that the political pressure would be immense. The accusations would be immense. Certainly he's in a bad position. I don't envy him, but could he stand up and say, look, we're going to reopen the investigation under the NTSB, which should be, without any type of government intrusion. At least that's the way it was set up in 26 and 1974, reaffirmed. Could he do that?
Yes, he could. Now, you know, according to the bylaws of the NTSB, no more than three of the five board members can be a member of aligned with a political party.
Okay.
So he's a Democrat. There's probably at least two other Democrats on the board then. And then the way they do this is the Republicans appoint good citizens, and the Democrats historically appoint hardball players, you know. But Hart is in a good position in a sense because he wasn't involved in the original.
Right.
They got rid of him before this, and he has a little grudge there, you know, for getting dumped in favor of, like, a guy named Jim Hall.
Yeah.
You know, it's as if they knocked off LeBron James and they put me in his place, you know what I mean? Like, and then he was reappointed after the petitioning process by the TW 800 project. So he's
right.
Not really aligned, you know, he's not part of that. So, you know, he has essentially the independence. What the problem is that these bureaucracies have a certain cultural memory, and that once you have this cumulative weight of what's happened in the past, it would take someone with real cojones to wade in and do this. And
yeah.
I don't know that that's he. I don't know him well enough to know one way or the other. Although
no.
You're right, Doug. It would be, what a great legacy. You know?
I mean, you know, and I had just recently spoken with a detective working at, and that's what I wrote about today that appears on Hagman Report and Canada Free Press. I'd recently met with a detective working at, it's almost a three-decade-old cold case homicide. And just to be in that position where the detective, many before him, chose just to go through the motions or not really follow through, you know, on these cold cases. They're worked to death, and they're just pushed aside. People die, the memories fade, and people have that attitude. What difference would it make now? But the difference is, you know, to the 230 families in this case, to the 230 victims.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and the implications, the national security implications, because in your book, and I won't give away anything out of your book, but certainly you make a great point about what happened in the sky that night, what happened to TWA 800. Not drawing any conclusions, carefully not drawing any conclusions as to who fired missiles, you know, from where. So.
And, you know, that remains something of a, you know, I don't go beyond my information.
Right.
What's curious and fascinating is that since the book's come out, even before it came out, after it appeared on your show, I hear every day from two or three people, on average, probably at least 100 so far, who have serious industry knowledge. Several of them from inside the investigation. And a couple patterns emerge. The group of people who are most offended by the final NTSB report, are, and I've gotten at least a dozen emails from this very specific group, and it'll start off like this. I worked 30 years of my life inside the 747 tanks. Let me tell you, there is no way in hell that a random spark, I mean, they're outraged, you know?
That's right.
One after another. Some of them are worked the investigation, right. You know? And others were, you know, work for Boeing, or they work for TWA, or they work for other airlines. They're utterly conversant in fuel tanks, you know? And one guy wrote, and, you know, you get these little critics involved too. I was disappointed that you didn't have a whole chapter on the functioning of a fuel tank.
Oh, know? My goodness.
Hey, I'm okay. Trying to, you know, read books, write books that people will read, you know?
Like, yeah.
But, well, you know, I mean, point taken, you know, but I said, you know, I'm happy to share your information, but it's just, you know, it's just hard for the average layman to follow.
I get
but
that.
The outrage is real, you know?
What would be the implications here, and we touched on it earlier, but I really want to readdress this as well. For this investigation to be reopened and taken, whether it be by Mr. Hart, well, hopefully by Mr. Hart, if reopening the investigation, it could be seen as a political maneuver right now, given the landscape of the political elections for 2016. But what do you think would be the national security ramifications by reopening the investigation? Could we, I mean, from a national security standpoint, are we going to be exposing, I'm not sure how to even frame that question, but are there any national security implications by reopening this?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's not impossible that, it seems likely. I mean, I followed the evidence where it went, and it ended up going someplace where rather it didn't go.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather terrorists should shut the plane down, and, you know, we could go after terrorists, and, but it seems almost, the evidence is overwhelming that the U.S. Navy was involved in this. It's not impossible that there was some terrorist element that snuck its way into this exercise, and then maybe they were firing at a terrorist plane, or there was a terror. I mean, I've heard, you know, from the various people who've communicated with me, several of them have suggested an alternative that, what's undeniable, though, is that the Navy was involved.
Right.
The Navy was there. The Navy P-3 was hovering right over the plane when it got blown out of the sky, and the P-3 is used, the P-3 Orion is used to coordinate information among combatants in a naval exercise, a missile test. We know that there were missile tests on July 7th off the coast of Long Island, and we have a video of one on July 12th. So it seems inevitable. If there was some top secret system being tested, that may have been the cover that the White House used to keep people in line, and that's not impossible. There has been reports that there was some, I've heard very credible reports from people, including one guy who loaded the missiles onto one of the subs in question, that they were using an experimental missile they'd never seen before. Now, that said, I can't say that with any, you know, full confidence. And
sure.
And that's why I would rather the people who know better, and what's encouraging to me is that I've heard from several people inside the Navy who are willing to take this the next step and are looking, searching databases I could never access, and
right.
Asking questions of people who would never respond to my questions. Among the people who's helping is the fellow who worked at the China Lake Naval Firing Range and I think he is, his resume backs us up. He said he has test fired more missiles and more airplanes than anyone in the world, you know. And he's on board and he's investigating, but there's so much of this stuff is compartmentalized that it's hard for even people who know a lot to get beyond their own, you know, silo or whatever they call those things.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's problematic, but not a hurdle that can't be cleared. So before, as we approach the top of the hour, I want to drive this home because our audience, listening audience number one, I really am proud of everyone who tunes in, listens, watches this broadcast. I really believe we've got a cut above average. The people who watch this program and listen to it are a cut above average. We've got police officers, we've got military personnel.
Yeah.
In fact, I heard from a couple of military personnel in advance of your appearance tonight about, I'll be tuned in. But Jack, what best, before, as we approach the top of the hour, how can anyone listening to this broadcast, how can they best help you? They contact you if they have information?
I'd say, Go to my website, which is cashel.com, C-A-S-H-I-L-L.com, and it'll tell you right at the top of the page how to contact me.
Okay.
And I respond to every... You put TW800 in the server address
subject
thing, whatever,
line.
And I will respond. And like I say, I've gotten some excellent leads, and I haven't even talked about the best ones yet. We could talk about that in the next stop in the next hour, including an air traffic controller who was there that night, and a fellow who worked on the missile team with the FBI.
Wow.
So, and they were, there's some great stories behind that that led to some other revelations. Right now, I'm at the point of just knocking on these people's doors saying, you can be a hero, you know? Step up. You know, so.
Truly, the gumshoe aspect of your investigative journalism is coming out because, yeah, I can see the shoe leather, whether it's actual shoe leather or
cyber
virtual.
Shoe leather.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And folks, you know, this is a time when you can make a difference. And you might be listening to this or watching this program, and perhaps you know someone. Maybe it's not you, but know someone. Urge that person to contact Jack Cashel, because this is an evolving, although the book has been written, and really, folks, if you haven't done so already, get a copy of this book. All right, TWA 800, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy, because once you read this book, you'll understand, you'll see exactly what Jack is talking about. Then, of course, if you know someone, even give them your copy or get another copy, Amazon. Put a review on Amazon as well, because the trolls are out there digging on the reviews. So we need to really elevate, uplift the book and Mr. Cashel. And if you're a member of conservative forums, I've been watching the commentary, Jack, on some of the conservative forums that are out there, and it's amazing to me that the mental disconnect, the people, I don't even know if we want to go here, but just the people who don't understand the significance of this event to today. It's almost as if, look, it happened 20 years ago. It's a distraction, diversion. We need to move on and address things more relevant today.
Yeah, I mean, commentary on any thing is a hit or miss proposition. I'm always encouraged by the people who make, you know, intelligent remarks and add information.
Yes.
You know, I like to see comments that add information. I mean, if you haven't read the book and you say, well, that can never happen. Well, you haven't read the book. I mean, come before you, you know, I mean, it's like, you know.
Exactly.
Oh, he's only in it for the money. Oh, he's beating a dead horse. You know, it's like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm in it for the money. If I was in it for the money, as I explained in the book, I'd have stayed in advertising.
Well, yeah. Successful man. And of course, you know, books, people have this misconception that authors are rich.
Right.
I don't quite get that. Anyway, folks, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report. You're watching the Hagman and Hagman Report. Of course, to my immediate right is Joe, my co-host, my son, fellow investigative researcher. Something I like to call, folks, America's premier father-son investigative team, right here on the Global Star Radio Network. And, of course, YouTube Live, simulcast on BTR as well. Tell a friend about a family member about this broadcast, and especially this broadcast, because it's so important as we enter into the final stages. What, 65 days left to the 2016 presidential campaign and elections? Hillary, Diane Rodham, the witch, the yak, Clinton. It's time for a yak. Go ahead, Eric. Release the yak. All right, the yak's going across. All right, there we go.
Jack, we'll have to show you that after.
Yeah, it's just something that, I don't know, I must have Tourette's or something, because I called her the yak.
But our guest, Jack Cashel, we'll be right back after this. Stay with us.